So I'm sure everyone here has seen AI in the news recently, maybe over the last year or two. And you're probably wondering whether this is just like a brief moment in the sun. You know, is it going to be like crypto or the metaverse? Or, you know, is this here to stay? And I'm here to say, basically, this is just the start. If we roll out the current techniques that we already have in education, in healthcare, in transport, in warfare, even just what we already have, it's going to be a profound shift in how we do many of the most essential tasks in our society. So why are some people concerned, right? I mean, you know, if we can transform healthcare, if we can transform education, why would we be worried? And I guess I'd like to illustrate this with just by talking about a coffee robot. So imagine I had like a general purpose robot and I'm sitting in faculty's offices. We've just moved in and we still haven't managed to get our coffee machine plumbed in. And so I have to send the robot down to get a coffee from the coffee shop below. And I say, robot, grab me a coffee fast as you can. And the robot plows through the door, races down to the coffee shop, and comes back up with a coffee. All right. Okay, bloody hell, robot. Okay, so the next day, I'm like, okay, robot, I'd like a coffee, but please don't smash the door. Just open the door, go through it. And so the robot steps on the cat. Okay, next day, robot, don't smash the door, don't step on the cat. Get me a coffee as fast as you can. So it runs downstairs and just steals a coffee from the hand of the person who's just got served their coffee. Okay, robot, don't smash the door, don't step on the cat, don't steal a coffee. But for whatever reason, the coffee shop is now on fire. And so the robot races in, starts making the coffee, comes back totally burned, like, you know, half the robot it was. Okay, robot, don't smash the door, don't step on the cat, but don't do this. And if there's some physical impediment, don't do it. And so the next day it's raining, and it just doesn't go out and doesn't bring me anything. This sounds silly, right? It sounds small, but hopefully it illustrates the actual difficulty of specifying a precise objective function for something that doesn't have your common sense. Like humans are, when I ask somebody to get me a coffee, there's an enormous amount of sort of common sense that goes alongside that we simply don't know how to put into computers right now. And so in the robot coffee example, maybe that's a little bit silly, but what happens if we start making very powerful AIs and we start putting them to work on really important problems? You know, things like fixing the climate, eliminating all cancer, eliminating war. And we know from mythology, humans have known for thousands of years that actually this is a hard problem, right? King Midas wanted to be wealthy. What he actually wished for was to turn everything to gold, everything he touched to gold. Very quickly, he found out the difficulty of specifying an objective function to be what you actually want, not what you say. And so I want to just show you a couple of videos. This is going to be a couple of minutes each. These are two CEOs of some of the most largest AI companies talking about how they see the future of AI.
Like to see, and what would you not like to see out of AI in the future?
So this is Sam Altman from OpenAI.
I mean, I think the best case is like so unbelievably good that it's like hard to, I think it's like hard for me to even imagine. Like I can sort of think about what it's like when we make more progress of discovering new knowledge with these systems than humanity has done so far, but like in a year instead of 70,000. I can sort of imagine what it's like when we kind of like launch probes out to the whole universe and find out really, you know, everything going on out there. I can sort of imagine what it's like when we have just like unbelievable abundance and systems that can sort of, you know, help us resolve deadlocks and improve all aspects of reality and kind of like let us all live our best lives. But I can't quite, like, I think the good case is just so unbelievably good that you sound like a really crazy person to start talking about it. And the bad case, and I think this is like important to say, is like lights out for all of us. I'm more worried about like an accidental misuse case in the short term, where, you know, someone gets a super powerful, like it's not like the AI wakes up and decides to be evil. And I think all of the sort of traditional AI safety thinkers reveal a lot about, more than about themselves than they mean to, when they talk about what they think the AGI is going to be like. But I can see the accidental misuse case clearly, and that's super bad.
Okay, so this is, that's Sam Altman from OpenAI talking about this. And then this is Dario Amodei from he was actually the person, the scientist probably most prominently associated with building GPT-3 in OpenAI, and then moved to start his own startup, Anthropic, which is maybe the third biggest of the kind of
off-releasing model AI labs. Paul Christiano recently on a podcast said he thinks there's a 50% chance. I think the way he phrased it was that the way he ends up passing away is something to do with AI. Do you think about percentage chance doom or?
Yeah, I think it's popular to give these percentage numbers, and you know, I mean, the truth is that I'm not sure it's easy to put a number to it. And if you forced me to, it would fluctuate all the time. You know, I think I've often said that, you know, my chance that something goes, you know, really quite catastrophically wrong on the scale of you know, human civilization, you know, it might be somewhere between 10 and 25% when you put together the risk of something going wrong with the model itself, with, you know, something going wrong with human, you know, people or organizations or nation states misusing the model, or it kind of inducing conflict among them, or just some way in which kind of society can't handle it. That said, I mean, you know, what that means is that there's a 75 to 90% chance that this technology is developed and everything goes fine. In fact, I think if everything goes fine, it'll go not just fine, it'll go really, really great. Again, this stuff about curing cancer, I think if we can avoid the downsides, then this stuff about, you know, about curing cancer, extending the human lifespan, you know, solving problems like mental illness. I mean, this all sounds utopian, but I don't think it's outside the scope of what the technology can do. So, you know, I often try to focus on the 75 to 90% chance where things will go right. And I think one of the big motivators for reducing that 10 to 25% chance is, you know, how great it'll, you know, is trying to increase the good part of the pie. And I think the only reason why I spend so much time thinking about that 10 to 25% chance is, hey, it's not going to solve itself. You know, I think the good stuff, you know, companies like ours and like the other companies have to build things, but there's a robust economic process that's leading to the good things happening. It's great to be part of it. It's, you know, it's great to be one of the ones building it and causing it to happen, but there's a certain robustness to it. And, you know, I find more meaning. I find more, you know, when this is all over, I think, you know, I personally will feel I've done more to contribute to, you know, whatever utopia results, if we focus, you know, if I'm able to focus on kind of, you know, reducing that risk that it goes badly or it doesn't happen, because I think that's not the thing that's not the thing that's gonna happen on its own. The market isn't going to provide that.
The lesson that I wanted to take from this is, one, powerful AI is probably coming. And two, once you put AI to important decisions, those decisions intrinsically contain a notion of ethics. And it will we will have to express our values in software. And so this discussion about how we use this technology has to involve everyone. And so that's what I'm hoping my talk is going to lay the foundations for today. What is AI and how does it work? How smart could AI actually get? What could we do about it, and what should we do about it? So what is AI and how does it work? So artificial intelligence is the field of research that tries to get computers to do things we think of as intelligent when done by humans. And so you'll know that Alan Turing was a totally crucial part of this in the early days. And he said this. I'll give you a second to read it. If a machine can think, it might think more intelligently than we do, and then where should we be? AI, over its history, has really had these two branches. One, the kind of good old-fashioned, what we now call good old-fashioned AI. Ultimately, this is really a kind of collection of techniques, but it's a lot to do with how do we put human expertise into computers in such a way that they then are able to compute things themselves. So they like iterate through the consequences. Then there's the machine learning approach. And so this is where we actually get algorithms to learn things from data. Now, that has become much, much more prevalent recently, basically because it performs much more effectively than the good old-fashioned approach. Now, learning things from data may sound extremely mysterious. It certainly did to me when I first encountered it. So I'm just going to try and explain briefly how that works. So let's imagine a sort of very artificial problem, a kind of like gentle problem. We want to separate cats from dogs. And we have a couple of measurements about them, maybe their weight and the tooth length or whatever. It doesn't really matter. And we as humans can look at this and see the dogs are the blue squares and the cats are the blue circles. And we know if there was a point that came on that graph, we'd be able to say whether it was a dog or a cat. Okay, but a computer doesn't know that. So how's a computer going to figure out what to guess? And so basically, the computer has to find a boundary that separates the cats and the dogs. And it does this by like guessing a boundary to begin with and then looking at how good that separation is. How many dogs are on one side, how many cats are on the other, basically what percentage in each case, and tries to find it so all the dogs are on one side and all the cats are on the other. So maybe it guesses a line like this to begin with. And it can see that, like, okay, I've got sort of 100% dogs on one side, but basically 50-50 dogs and cats on the other. And then it makes a new guess. Now it's got 100% cats on one side, two-thirds dogs and one-third cat on the other, slightly better. And it keeps incrementing until it finds a boundary where, okay, now I've got all dogs one side, all cats the other. That's great. And so if a new data point comes in, like this, a triangle like this, the computer can just look at the boundary. Is it the dog side of the boundary or is it the cat side of the boundary? And make a guess. Okay, it's a dog. Right? And so that is all that learning from data really requires. Find a boundary between different parts of the system in a way that distinguishes the categories, and then use that boundary to make predictions afterwards. So it's really not that mysterious. Now, of course, in this circumstance, I've got a very straight line here. That has only two parameters, so there's a limited amount that I can fit to. And this is where neural networks come in. So neural networks are a more complicated algorithm. They have nonlinear, they have the ability to do nonlinear fitting, and they have millions, billions, or even trillions of parameters these days. And so you should think of them as being able to let you do really subtle boundaries like this. Now, in this particular circumstance, that doesn't really add that much advantage. But of course, I've only got two categories that I'm predicting, dogs and cats. But like, let's say I was predicting all the animals, you know, giraffes, rhinos. I've got a 9-month-old boy, so I like know lots of animals these days. And let's imagine that rather than just measuring two things about them, I was measuring 10, 50, 1,000. And so neural networks let us take in thousands of inputs, give out outputs into thousands of categories, and do this kind of fitting, but in not just two-dimensional space, like I'm showing here, not just three-dimensional space, but in very high-dimensional space. So you won't be able to visualize it, but sort of keep in your mind the picture of three-dimensional space and volumes in three-dimensional space, finding like a volume that represents cats, a volume that represents dogs, and then if the new point falls inside that, making that your prediction. Okay, so how does ChatGPT work? Which really is basically this process. So I'm sure basically everyone, can people just sort of nod know what ChatGPT is. So ChatGPT basically follows this process, except of course we can't tell it we can't tell it up front what a particular word means. So what we do instead is we gather enormous amounts of data from the internet. Millions and millions and millions of sentences, essentially every sentence on the internet. And then we mask one of the words. So a dog has four. And we show this to ChatGPT and we say, please predict the next word. And so maybe it predicts eyes. Okay, and then we compare the two things and we say, because we know the real sentence and we know its prediction, and we say, ChatGPT, you got that wrong. Now adjust those boundaries, the kind of the equivalent of that line, but in this high-dimensional space of all words, adjust those boundaries such that you predict legs next time. And then we do that millions and millions and millions of times on all kinds of different sentences, to the point where it actually learns to predict all those words really pretty effectively. Okay, so you're now basically at the cutting edge of AI in terms of how these things work. And I guess I'm trying to emphasize that because I do want people to take away from this that these aren't magical techniques. They're actually quite understandable, quite simple in principle, if like very complicated to actually implement at the scales that people, like the amount of data and the amount of compute you have to deal with is enormous and really hard. But the mathematical principles are actually not too bad. So how smart could AI get? Well, you initially might just sort of start thinking about a capability spectrum like this, somewhere between low to high. And, you know, you pick an AI, like some kind of artificial intelligence, maybe a chess computer, and that seems to sit high. Okay, but where do I sit relative to that? So a chess computer can beat me at chess, so maybe I sit lower. But a chess computer can't recognize a cat from a dog, can't walk around, can't order a beer in a pub. How do we like conceptualize these on a single axis? And I think obviously intelligence is much more multidimensional, but it's useful just to even separate it into two dimensions. So including some notion of generality. And so a chess computer is high capability in a narrow environment, basically a single environment. It can optimize really well inside that single environment. Whereas I am a much more general intelligence, perhaps not as high capability in that single environment, but I can optimize for my goals across a very broad range of environments. And then perhaps ChatGPT sits somewhere in the middle. Okay, but is there a way to properly compare those? That's very heuristic-y. Can we do a proper comparison? Well, sort of is the answer. So a floating point operation is, you should just think of it as like a very basic operation in a computer, like kind of like adding two numbers together. And so if we count the number of floating point operations, we can at least compare the amount of compute that different algorithms use in their training runs. And so this here is the compute used on some of the famous algorithms for the last 50 years. You can see that it's very like got a very exponential character. And this point outlier at the top there is GPT-4. And it's gone up 10 million times in the last 10 years. Okay, but to show the next year or two, I have to shrink all of those data points down to this. And that is now the estimated, what people think, sort of GPT-5 level algorithms are going to spend on compute. Hundreds of millions, maybe even billions in a single training run. So, I don't know how many people are familiar with log plots, but basically this is now the same data just shown on a log plot. It basically allows you to kind of condense exponentials so you can view them more easily. Because what we'd really like to do is try and compare this to a human brain. Now, this is like there are massive caveats on these calculations. We don't really understand how a human brain works well enough to make a really high-quality comparison to a conventional, like a classical computer. However, I still think it's informative because we can sort of make bounded estimates, like the kind of simplest version or the most complicated version, and see where they fall. And so if we estimate in the 18 years, the first 18 years of life, roughly how many sort of flop equivalents do we think the human brain uses, so effectively the training time up to 18, where do we think it falls on this plot? So roughly around the kind of levels of modern algorithms. Now you might say, okay, but if we took an 18-year-old and if we took a baby and raised them in a state of nature for 18 years, they would never get close to the understanding of a modern human. We are only at this level because of all the culture. I think that's true. So we can start to put all human brains that have ever existed on this spectrum. Now, we're still quite a long way off, certainly a long way off the top of that, but we're starting to approach the bottom. Of course, big caveats on whether we can actually do these calculations effectively. Now, something that will run through many people's heads is, aren't human beings somehow special? Is this not too mechanistic, reductionist, to try and compare the compute, like in this really obvious fashion? I would claim not, and in fact, I would claim that that kind of magical thinking has actually misled science in a bunch of circumstances. So this is the pre-Copernican understanding of the universe, with the Earth right at the very center and everything else orbiting around. We had a very central, special place. We now know that in our galaxy, well, we're not even the center of our solar system, never mind the center of our galaxy. In biology, we thought we were put here by God. We were given a very, very special place. And nowadays, we think we evolved like all the other animals. In quantum mechanics, for a decent period of time, probably a couple of decades, people genuinely wondered whether it required consciousness to decohere a wave function. Nowadays, our modern understanding is that basically if you took a rock the same size as my body, it would have exactly the same effect on any quantum superposition as a conscious entity. And so in all three of those cases, we've sort of tried to start from a notion of human specialness and then construct a theory of science around that. And that has ultimately led us down, I think, false paths. And it was only when we gave up the notion of human specialness that we were able to get to a more truthful understanding. And so if I asked you at the start where somebody like Einstein would sit on this graph, you might have put him somewhere at the top right. I actually think when we understand this all more properly, we'll find he's at a much less special location, somewhere in the middle. For slightly technical reasons, I actually think he'll turn out to be on the right-hand side, but lower down. I'm happy to answer questions about it at the end if people are interested. But that does then, genuinely provoke the question, what is in the top right of this plot? And so this is where people will start talking about superintelligences. So these are an artificial intelligence that is at least as general as us and much more capable. Now, people's default notion immediately when thinking about this is to sort of anthropomorphize it as either a god or a devil and nothing in between. I actually think it's much more sensible, it's a much better mental model to think of it as sort of a bit more like a universal chess computer. So in the same way that a chess computer has some goal to checkmate the opposition, has an understanding of the board and the actions it can take, the pieces it can move, I think it's better to think of a superintelligence as kind of this disembodied idea of it has some goals, whatever we've either programmed it with or it's learned, and it can make moves in the real world with whatever actions it has available to it, and it has an understanding of the world. But don't get immediately suckered into thinking about Terminator, because it just leads down weird paths about good and evil and those kind of narratives. Whereas Sam said, and Dario would have said, but didn't quite, it's actually these accidental misuse cases that are more concerning. But is a superintelligence possible? Is there a totally crucial question here? And the answer is we don't know. So nobody has built one, as far as we know. And so we can't say for certain it's possible. But we can say that there is no known theory of science that prevents it. And in fact, in many ways, our existing computers are like more capable than our biological hardware. Like they can send signals faster, they can store signals for longer times, they can retrieve things with higher veracity. And so I think you have to, like, the extraordinary claim that demands extraordinary evidence is positing that a superintelligence can't be built rather than that it can. So what could we do about AI? The first thing that many people will immediately default to is, well, let's just build it, and if something starts going wrong, let's just pull the plug. Let's just turn it off. And I'd like to convince you that that is not obviously possible. So let's take a slightly hypothetical scenario. So let's go back to one of the problems at the start. Maybe build a powerful AI, and we want to use it to prevent global warming. And so we set it going, and it looks around at the world, and it says, okay, I'm slightly anthropomorphizing it here. I shouldn't really do that very, it has a goal of turning, preventing global warming, and it recognizes that there are actors out there whose livelihoods depend on the production of carbon in the atmosphere, and who could, in principle, turn it off. The first, like, or pretty soon after coming up with a plan for how you fix global warming, you're going to want to come up with a plan to stop those bad actors from turning you off. And so maybe you just copy yourself to every computer on the internet. And so if we can come up with an idea in 10 seconds that, like, means a kind of intelligence wouldn't be easily turned off, imagine what a real superintelligence could do. Now, that's not to say there aren't ideas about how you create an AI with an off switch. So a professor called Stuart Russell at Berkeley has a set of ideas where you insist that the intelligence maintains great uncertainty about human preferences. And so that means that whenever it tries to act in some way that it has thinks will have important repercussions, it checks back with the humans to ensure that it's doing the right thing. So in that circumstance, you do maintain some sense of an off switch, but that doesn't come by default. Like, you have to have built that in a thoughtful way at the start. It's actually not obvious that if you just, like, let things happen and trained the most powerful agents you could, that there would be an obvious off switch in the way you might imagine to begin with. So how should we think about the space of this kind of intelligence block? Well, in this top right corner, there is some genuine unknown territory. However, in this green area, there's a lot of safe region. So in the top right, there is, you know, a whole set of potential technologies that we can't currently understand and can't currently control. In the green region, we do understand them, and we can control them. Like, artificial intelligence has been used totally safely for decades in the real world. And so I think it's important that we don't let kind of hypothetical concerns about the red area slow us down from making taking advantage of the value in the green area. You know, the UK is facing a pretty devastating prosperity crisis. Our GDP is roughly flatlined since 2008. And AI is one path of improving that. It'll build great technology companies that will actually meaningfully change the way we live. It'll improve education, security, renewable energy, healthcare. I can give examples of a bunch of these if people are interested at the end. And the AI required to do this is completely safe. We totally understand all the elements of it and can completely control it. In this red zone, though, there is a very reasonable question whether we should build this at all. And the proponents of building it will say to you, well, look at the world. We still have plenty of unsolved problems, whether it's global warming or disease or pandemics or nuclear weapons, et cetera, et cetera. And powerful AI can be a path to solving these. If the world is bottlenecked on anything, it's probably bottlenecked on intelligence. And powerful AI could be a path through. But critics will say, you know, it is unknown and it's not obviously safe. And the dynamics of building it are genuinely complicated. Individuals, nations, companies, they all have reasons to race a bit more than they'd like, whether it's for wealth or fame or power.
The Gresham College lecture that you're listening to right now is giving you knowledge and insight from one of the world's leading academic experts. Making it takes a lot of time, but because we want to encourage a love of learning, we think it's well worth it. We never make you pay for lectures, although donations are needed. All we ask in return is this: send a link to this lecture to someone you think would benefit, and if you haven't already, click the follow or subscribe button from wherever you're listening right now. Now, let's get back to the lecture.
And so one way we tend to solve these problems is via regulation. But we struggle to regulate very well understood domains like housing or energy. Is it really realistic that we'll regulate a hypothetical unknown technology effectively in a way that actually ends up making things safer? And poor regulation could easily make things worse. If it privileges bad actors over good actors, you could easily make things less safe without trying very hard. And so there's this constant debate across Twitter between these different sides. And I'd like to try to slightly unpack that for you. Because I think there are two fundamental, crucial questions that underlie this that enable us to have a bit more thoughtful discussion. And the first is, how long until we build superintelligence? Do we have a long time? Do we have a short time? Now, 5-10 years ago, the long time, you would have found people who said we probably have like a century or two. And on the short time, you'd have found people who said maybe 10 years. I'd say, on average, the field has dramatically shortened its timeframes. And now the people who say the long time are like, you know, a few decades. And the people who say a short time say 2 to 5 years. And then how easy would it be to what we call align superintelligence, but basically get a superintelligence to care about us? Would it be a hard problem? And would it be an easy problem? That's just a technical question that we don't know the answer to right now. And so if we lay those out on a 2x2, we end up with something like this. And there's two categories that I'd like to talk about today, just in the interest of time. The sort of very optimistic and the very pessimistic. So the very optimistic think we have a long time and it's going to be really easy to get it to care about us. The very pessimistic think it's going to be an extremely hard problem to get it to care about us, to align it to our values, and we have a relatively short time before it comes. And so the pessimists have very strict interventions that they want to make. They want to stop the proliferation of this technology, stop most research, maybe create a single global research center to try and reduce this kind of race condition that everyone's facing. The optimists, on the other hand, think this is going to be an easy problem. We've got ages to figure it out. The technologies that you work on to try and make things safe right now aren't actually going to be the technologies that it's built with. So we should just encourage research, and we should deploy this stuff widely. Make compute easily available, embrace open source. And both have very valid criticisms of the other. And so the optimists will say to the pessimists, if you stop proliferation, the technology will be controlled by fewer people, by definition. If you stop most research, you'll limit the other good applications of AI. And if you create a single research center, you'll make it very easy for countries to defect and have their own like black programs and use that kind of imbalance for their own security or economic prosperity. But of course, the pessimists will say to the optimists, if you encourage research and it turns out to be hard and soon, you are basically making it more likely that we create superweapons. And if you deploy it widely, you're putting them in the hands of everyone. And the truth is, nobody knows the answer to these two questions. Nobody knows where the actual world really sits. Is it actually going to be turn out to be really hard to get these things to align to our values, or is it going to be easy? Is it actually going to be a few years, or is it going to be much, much longer? Actually, I think probably the right attitude is to kind of fill in all the regulations on this 2x2 and then say, how do we mitigate the worst downsides and take advantage of the most of the upsides? But what's the current approach? Well, unfortunately, the current approach is sort of to build powerful but uncontrolled and poorly understood algorithms kind of on the cusp of this red and green zone, which does not seem ideal. And so what would a better version be? There's perhaps two paths that strike me as safer. One is a kind of incrementalist approach, building up from this green zone and trying to kind of safely take steps, modular steps as we go. And the other is to start in the red zone, but use kind of formal mathematical guarantees that what we're doing is actually safe. I also think it's worth taking a look at the wider world and seeing what we can learn from other industries. And so, you know, one of the things that seems important is in the early stages of training these models, we protect intellectual property carefully with copyright, and people demand, or people rightly get the value of what they're doing. And so it feels like an important lesson for AI as well. Although it is worth pointing out that that has now descended into people extending and re-extending and re-extending copyright to the point where the system, it probably is starting to limit creative thought on that end as well. Then in the nuclear power industry, they have extremely careful safety standards. Before you can build a nuclear power station, you have to give all kinds of quantitative numbers to demonstrate the safety of your nuclear power reactor, which means that we do have relatively few nuclear incidents. Of course, the kind of contrary side to that is that actually they have sufficiently limited the application of nuclear power that now more people die of the kind of effects of air pollution from coal than die from nuclear incidents. In the cyber domain, we do what's called red teaming, where people who build systems will hire external people to attack these systems and then use any weaknesses that are found to make the systems better. This seems like an important concept that we can lift across for AI. From the pharmaceutical industry, we can learn from clinical trials. So before we put a drug out into the world, we're very careful to make sure it's tested in every regard possible so that it can be as safe as possible. Although, of course, the downside to this one is that people say this process is now taking too long and too expensive, and actually it's harming people by preventing good medicines from getting out rather than purely a safety factor. In finance, we have know your customer. And as we start to build powerful AI systems, we'll probably want some notion of understanding who has access to them and what they're doing with them. Although, again, in the finance industry, billions and billions are being spent on knowing know your customer, KYC, with relatively little reduction in fraud. And finally, in aerospace, if there's ever an accident, there's a very truth-seeking investigation on trying to figure out what happened, like a sort of very carefully blame-free culture, so that we really understand exactly what failed, so that we can make these things safer over time. That feels like another important place where we could learn. But are there approaches that are actually technically safer? So these are kind of mostly procedural. Are there approaches that are technically safer? And the answer is yes. So here are four: the open agency architecture from Davidada Arya, inverse reinforcement learning from Stuart Russell, I already mentioned, beneficial AI roadmap from Yoshua Bengio, and human-led AI, what we are working on at faculty. And so all of these, none of these are complete answers to the solution by any means, but all of them have directionally geared at building safer AI systems, basically either working in that red zone. So the first three are kind of working in the red zone of making more provably safe AI, and the faculty version is working in the green zone and building up the more incrementalist approach. So I'll just take 2 minutes to explain a little bit about this approach. So we've designed it to be both powerful and trusted, and that means that there are sort of three basic tenets for every system that's built according to these principles. So it's fundamentally safe, built in from the foundations of every AI system that we would build, and every algorithm has a governance mechanism controlling its actions. It's modular, so that each component can be separately tested and understood. So it means that you really can build in this incremental approach, making sure things are safe as you go. And it is fundamentally human first. So it is explainable both structurally and algorithmically. And so basically what this means is humans can actually look at the systems and understand what they're doing and why in such a way that they can make good choices about whether to implement it or not. And this is being used right now. It's being used in the NHS to help patients move through hospitals more effectively. And so, you know, obviously the NHS has a very big backlog at the moment. And one of the things that will be helpful is making sure that as soon as someone's ready to leave hospital, they're able to as fast as possible. And so our systems are helping make better decisions, helping nurses make better decisions so that they can get patients out as fast as possible, and starting to be used in the commercial sector as well. So, what should we do about AI? I think the kind of first thing to say is that talking about AI as a single unified field is like talking about physics as a single unified field. On one hand, in physics, we have like radios. On the other hand, we have nuclear weapons, right? And if you just talked about regulating physics, it would be kind of nonsensical. But that is, unfortunately, the sort of position that we are in the debate in AI today. And so at the very least, we need to start carving out these two categories. The safe zone, where we do need to go as fast as reasonably possible, because our like education, health, wealth, all will benefit from it. The red zone, I think it is sensible to be cautious. The problem is, it's not totally clear what the right way to be cautious is. Is the sensible path to regulate with all the downsides and complexities of regulation? Or should we build in a more open fashion in the kind of open source ideals of many eyes make light bugs or make shallow bugs? And crucially, if we are to build these things, what values should AI represent? Unfortunately, that is not a question I can answer for you. That is a question for all of us. And while this may seem slightly unsatisfying as an ending, building transformative AI is going to force us to decide what it means to be human. We are going to have to decide what we put into these algorithms, what we care about, and what we're willing to fight for. And at the moment, we are just in the middle of the story. There is no ending right now. The end will depend on the decisions made by people in this room. Thank you very much.
Gosh, Mark, that was a brilliant sort of sweep across everything. I'm in awe of what you were talking about. Now, my name's Richard Harvey. I'm a former professor of IT here at Gresham College, and my job is to negotiate the questions coming in from Slido. If you're in the physical audience, you too can type into Slido, and that's what we prefer here. And the virtual audience is then on equal footing. So, loads of questions, as you might imagine. Let's start about start with bias. So there's a question here. It said, could more be said about boundaries and bias in building AI and its ability or otherwise to counter inbuilt bias, for example, gender bias and for health treatments and so on? And I suppose a biased AI perhaps isn't the sort of killer AI that one might have imagined, but it's certainly a bad AI.
Certainly. And so yes, so AI can be biased. It certainly depends on the training data. Although it is interesting in that once you put something into maths, it's actually often easier to fix faster because human brains are, well, we've tried for centuries, maybe millennia, to remove bias from human brains. That process hasn't gone brilliantly. And so for certain types or certain elements of particular decisions, I certainly wouldn't advocate for wholeheartedly just putting entire decisions into an AI model. But for certain elements of it, yes, we definitely can build models. We can ensure that they are less biased. But you have to be careful for a variety of technical reasons. But I just, one like slight kind of tangent to that question. In the world of AI, there's often a perceived tension between these kind of short-term risks and the longer-term risks. So people talk about like AI ethics as different to kind of AI safety. And you know, there are all sorts of inside baseball fights between whose bit is more important. And I think that's just fundamentally a mistake. I like to use the analogy of a car. Like, I want seatbelts and I want a catalytic converter because I care about the short-term risks of crashes, but I care about the long-term risks of global warming. And I think insisting that you have to do one or you have to do other of those is just fundamentally a mistake. The crucial element is that you actually balance both and you're basically thoughtful about both.
Super, yeah. So what I mean, there's quite a few questions here on this theme. And I thought I was listening to your talk, Mark. I thought, what a pity it is that we don't know more about ourselves, you know, because that would make life so much easier, because then we would be able to measure all of your axes and so on and so on. Do you know of any progress on that? You know, so for characterizing intelligence, for example, or even characterizing malevolence in any numerical way?
I know obviously there's tons and tons of neuroscience going on. I am very far from an expert in that. I'm not sure. So I think people feel like as we step forward in our knowledge of AI, we can sort of make analogies back to the human brain, but I don't know that anyone would want to. So there's obviously the neuroscience path, but from the AI path, I don't know that anyone would want to claim strongly that the way AI does things, it's like directionally indicative rather than perhaps like a strong scientific claim.
So, I mean, someone here is asking, what are your projections around AGI, which I think probably means advanced general intelligence, doesn't it?
Yes.
Given that there's been no tangible progress on this front, even by companies like OpenAI, whose best product is ML, machine learning. Now, I'm not sure if that assertion is completely true, but perhaps behind it is the how do you measure generality of an AI?
Yes. So these are huge questions. I think
I've asked you two questions there. One is the question online, and then there's
the
question.
One way is we just construct a bunch of tests. So, you know, the first instance was get a load of computer games and see whether a single algorithm can win at multiple computer games. And then you start taking tests, so, you know, different subject matter tests, law, biology, physics, and you see whether the same algorithm can do well on a bunch of those tests. And so I think, you know, it seems fairly clear that we are making progress in that. Like, it's GPT 3, 4 have substantially increased our ability to have a single algorithm solve tests in very different domains. So I don't think I I basically don't think I agree with the underlying assumption of the question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think we are making progress. How fast is really going to depend on what extra scientific breakthroughs we need. So I don't think that LLMs, as they're these large language models, the name for the algorithm that sits behind ChatGPT, I don't think those are enough for general intelligence in the way that most people mean it. But we get into some quite detailed, specific questions around definitions here. So maybe I will say, I think there's probably a step or two at least between like an LLM and what I would consider general intelligence, but, and it is unclear how long those steps are going to take.
Mm. Yeah, perhaps we need sort of A-levels for AI, don't we? test their ability.
I think the AI would pass A-levels.
Yeah,
you need like PhDs these days.
Yeah, I'm sorry to say, it probably would. Okay, so here's an interesting one. I mean, people picked up on the faculty approach, which obviously you're the expert on, the sort of human governance loops around things. But somebody here is asking, how would that work with an autonomous system that has to work quickly, like, say, an autonomous weapon system?
Yeah.
You can't loop back and ask, do I have permission to fire?
Well, so there in principle, you can always say that at the far edge, there's just going to be an autonomous system that is totally autonomous and never talks to a human. And that can't be human-led in this regard. However, what you can do is you can have humans make more strategic decisions that set the framework for the execution of a more local decision. So let's talk about a circumstance that faculty would work in. It's like something to do with perhaps digital marketing. So, you know, digital marketing is, you know, there are these exchanges where transactions happen on the millisecond. And obviously, a human being is not going to execute every one of those transactions. But the human being can set the framework for the strategy, how much you want to spend in what given time on what types of campaign, and then can set the governance protocols that sit around the algorithm. So, do this, don't do that. If you spend this much in this unit time, then stop trading, these kinds of things. And so you can often, in most real-world circumstances, you can abstract up a level, set the strategy at that level, and set the governance at the level of actual execution.
Yeah, great answer. Here's a good one. How feasible is it to draw the boundary between the red zone and the green zone?
Hard. Yeah. I think I don't know that we have to be super precise, though, for the purposes of ensuring safety. So yeah. we definitely know where...
Maybe the boundary doesn't really matter. What matters is you know the endpoints.
Exactly. Yeah. We definitely know a bunch of things that sit in the green zone. Those we can go fast on. And then, in some sense, there's a fuzzy boundary to the red zone, and then it's going to be our decision on how much risk we choose to take in that boundary.
And there's an interesting question here, which I've temporarily lost, but let me paraphrase, which is, so AI is very dependent on its training data. And the questioner is asking about data poisoning. So you could imagine an AI going bad, not because the designer made it bad, but because the data it ingested was bad or was corrupted in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Those possibilities must be included in these frameworks.
Well, so, I mean, the framework I gave today is extremely high level to try and fit as much of a sweep in as possible. In the detail, there are many, like the kind of coffee robot failure mode, there are many, many examples of sort of equivalent failure modes that can happen, including sort of a data poisoning such that the coffee robot thinks it's executing on what I asked, but in fact is doing something completely different. That's totally true. And people are working on a variety of paths, including just making sure the data is reasonably good to kind of solve that.
So when you're talking about AI, you are implicitly talking about not only the algorithm, but also the data that feeds it. This sort of classic ChatGPT problem, isn't it?
For sure.
It's ingesting stuff that might not have been safe in the first place.
Agreed. So, I mean, of course, the way our algorithms work at the moment, mostly, is that they get trained, and then that trained model goes into production. So it's sort of like, you know, in the training phase, they're like clay, they get shaped into their form, and then they get fired, and that fired version goes into production. So depending on exactly the circle, it gets quite complicated, but it's like, at least in the narrow sense, for a certain class of algorithms, the data poisoning would have to happen before they were trained, not when they're in production.
And given I'm a professor, here's a question that is, I'm going to select purely out of self-interest. How do we stop students using AI to cheat on their tests? Ask someone here. The AI might be innocent, but the use of the AI is not innocent.
Certainly. Well, so as somebody who used to be in academia and now isn't, I actually think we should be encouraging students in some sense to cheat on their test. As in, I think we have to reformulate exams to embrace these technologies. Like, in the next few years, we're going to be able to give every student a kind of personal tutor of the like that we haven't really had in society since, you know, von Neumann and, you know, the early 20th century, some of these totally brilliant physicists who had their own, like, PhD student who would tutor them from the age of 7 upwards. Like, that is a magnificent opportunity to transform education. And if the sacrifice is we can't do exams in exactly the same way that we used to, we have to change that, okay, I'll pay that price any day of the week.
Yeah, great answer. So we're just coming to the end of it, but tell us about Einstein, because you didn't put him on the right of your general intelligence.
No, I did. What I would say is I think there will turn out to be some notion, in computing, we have this notion of a universal classical computer. If you can do certain logic gates, then you are able to do any classical computation in the world. And then that was for a long time thought to be it. If you just had those logic gates, you could perform any computation. Then David Deutsch introduced this notion of a universal quantum computer. Can't do any fundamentally different computation, but it can do certain things exponentially faster. And so there's now a universal quantum computer and a universal classical computer. I think it, basically leaning on David Deutsch's ideas, it'll turn out that humans are basically a universal explainer, as in we can create explanatory theories equivalent to any superintelligence. And so basically, while I think we could have versions of superintelligence that could have much, much greater memory, much, much greater processing power, so be considerably above us in capability, I don't think we'll have them that can be more general than us, because we are already as general as it gets. And so that's why I actually think Einstein will be located on the far right of my plot, but not the top right corner.
Right. Great answer. Great end to what was a great talk. For those of you who asked questions, I'm so sorry we couldn't get through them all. There must be 100 here. Sorry about that. For those of you in person, I guess you're around for a few minutes, so people can badger you. Other than that, Mark, thank you very much indeed.